Thank you for tuning in to WPVMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Mostly sunny across western North Carolina today, a high near 91 here in the city, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. For tonight, chance of showers and thunderstorms, patchy fog developing, the low around 70. A chance of showers and thunderstorms on Saturday. Some of those storms could be strong to severe. We'll see a high near 87. Showers and thunderstorms for Saturday night. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio. I'm your host, James Nave. I wonder what we will discover today. I have a guest. Her name is Lisa Carver. She goes by her last name, Carver, like I go by my last name, Nave. I met Carver a couple of weeks ago in Taos, New Mexico. She's from Charleston, South Carolina. She's a singer-songwriter and spent much of her professional time in Nashville up until about 7 years ago, when she just decided the Nashville scene was a little bit more than she wanted to deal with, and she moved on. So after a bit of a hiatus, Carver's coming back into the musical world again. And when I saw her perform last weekend, I was gobsmacked at how well she presented her work. She's a real pro. So I'm lucky to have her on the show today. So let's turn to the conversation that Carver and I had, and you can share the experience along with me. So Carver begins by telling us a bit about her experience in Nashville. So here you go.
I was signed to a few publishing deals in Nashville. And I was just always, I knew when I got out and heard other people's music when I was on the songwriting scene, I thought, man, I like those kind of dark story songs, and I like songs that are just not traditional Nashville or what they were doing at the time. But I had a friend talk me into getting a publishing deal with Sony and Big Alpha, and had a great publisher. I loved Laura. She was married to a producer at the time named James Stroud, who was producing all kind of people, Toby and Willie, and I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know how to co-write. And that is a thing in Nashville. You have to learn how to co-write. So I credit people like Candy Karen and these people that they would throw me in rooms with. And I was terrible. I mean, I'll just be honest. I was out doing shows. Talmadge and I had started a thing called Girls with Guitars years before that. And I was allowed to write whatever I wanted. And my nature, I just go for the story songs. I was raised by the best storytelling mama in the world, Jenny Carver. And I love that kind of music. So that's what I was doing. And they signed me and said, oh, that's great. That's great. You can do that. But then they're looking for a Jason Aldean cut. And so they say, well, that's great. We love that you do that. But we need an up-tempo, something poppy, something with tailgates and Daisy Dukes and trucks. And I wish, if I had it to do over again, I would have said, hell no, that's not what I do. I'll be over here writing by myself. But I tried, because I was so like, oh my God, they like what I do. They signed me, they're paying me. And so I tried to be a team player, and I don't think I'm a very good team player. I started resenting it, having to write a commercial thing that I just wasn't feeling. And it was fun, because you can learn the crafting. On one hand, it was fun because crafting is important too. But I felt like it changed who I was as an artist.
Well, what about the classic singer-songwriters? Willie Nelson, you mentioned him, Kris Kristofferson. Oh, yeah. Parton, Joni Mitchell. Yes. I could go on if I knew more of them. Who are some of the other classic songwriters?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you named some of my favorites. I was raised in a gospel and very traditional country. That's what my parents listened to. My mom was a gospel singer. My dad, he loved Hank Williams. I love Hank Williams. He loved Johnny Cash, all those guys that my dad would play while he worked. That was the kind of music I loved. But I also have a major crush on Tom Waits and Leonard Cohen. Those, as I got older and started finding my own songwriters that I loved, those were the guys that I just adored. Christofferson, oh, I was behind him at the BMI Awards. And I didn't usually get freaked out by stars, but my friend Stephanie Smith was laughing because I just wanted to touch his shoulder and say, oh my God, you meant so much to me. And I just couldn't do it. It was like touching the robe of Jesus. I was like, but I absolutely. And she laughed at me. She goes, Carver, what is wrong with you? Just say hi to him. And I couldn't do it because he is sacred to me. He always was. I went to Nashville wanting to be a female Christofferson. But when I finally, you know, I had babies and got married, did all that. And then I woke up one day and went, oh, wait, I came here to write songs. And I got out there and they just weren't writing those kind of songs in Nashville at the time.
Is that still the case now?
You know, there are some great songs and writers that break through. But for the most part, you know, it's business. It's people trying to keep their doors open. They need to get a song for radio. And Christofferson, he couldn't get arrested in that town now. I mean, you still have great artists. I love Chris Stapleton. He used to do my demos for my grandma's strawberry cake. And he always had that thing where he could write commercial for other artists. But boy, he had his own way of saying things. And I'm so glad Nashville finally came around and made that guy a star because he's a true artist. But a lot of times there are young kids that come in with stars in their eyes. And I love that. But a lot of times they're told, this is what you're going to sing. You know, they put you in the rooms with other writers and they're saying, we need a commercial. We need an up-tempo or we need a mid-tempo. You know, and that's great. That's great. I love the years I had there. I got to meet my heroes. I had some amazing times, but at some point I had some personal tragedies and I just felt like what I was writing was ringing hollow with me. I wasn't feeling it. I was just showing up, drinking a cup of coffee and, you know, saying, what do you have? What kind of title? I did have a few artists that, I'll never forget. Ryan Griffin came in to write with me and it was after my sister had been killed. And I just didn't have a sense of humor about it anymore. I just went, if you can't make me feel something, let's just go to lunch, you know? And I said, man, if you can make me cry, we're going to write a good song. And he told me a story that made me cry. And we wrote a song called I Would Have Left Me Too, that to this day is just something I feel it. I feel the fact that he came in with an open heart and he was trying to write his first record. And I responded to that. But a lot of times in Nashville, it's, well, I have this line that I picked up from such and such, you know, you look good in them shorts. And I'm just like, I can't, it was hard for me to write from that kind of thing. And occasionally, you know what I mean? That was,
I know.
That
sounds, I've written a lot of poetry. I mean, I can write. I like to. I love to write. But I have friends like Nathan Brown and Walter Parks. They're singer-songwriters. They put together songs. And it's always been a real mystery to me how that works. Now, I've always had a couple of lines. I've got, like, you can develop this song for me. It's, get me drunk and call me darling. If you ain't been lied to, you ain't been loved. And
I can do something with that.
That's as far as I've gotten.
That's great. You ain't been loved.
Yeah, and I didn't write that, but I was talking to somebody, and we were talking about heartbreak, and I think she was from the South because that's a Southern thing. You ain't been lied to, you ain't been loved, and exactly. She was going on and on and on about some tragedy that she had had. She said, yeah, if you ain't been lied to, you ain't been loved. And I said, I've got to write that one down because I'd had the other one where, you know, get me drunk and call me darling. And then I thought, well, I'll put those two together. That's as far as I've gotten. I've tried to do a bit of it, but it hasn't really worked out that well.
but you're a poet. I mean, how cool to just hang with somebody that can do some music. You throw some lines and you start vibing, and it just whatever's in the room that day. I always loved it when somebody would come in and be shy, and they would just, you know, sit there, and I'm kind of like, hey, what happened this week? What's going on in your world? Got your heart broken lately? You know what? I would love to pull a story. To me, I would always be holding the guitar, playing something. And if somebody said a line that we could both catch a wave on, that's when the good stuff happens. I would set expectations. I got in the rooms with some of my heroes. And sometimes it was amazing. And other times you would just think, how are we canceling each other out? You know, sometimes it's like you just can't quite catch the wave. And it was almost always a good time where you just get to hang and know somebody and hear their story, and amazing people in Nashville and the rooms I've been thrown into and I've been led into, which have been really great human connection experiences. And there have been others. I had one guy come in, and he goes, these are my three titles. Pick one. And then he starts playing the guitar, and I was like, I don't like any of them. Now what? Can we just talk and hang, you know? And if people were willing to get vulnerable and open up, we usually came up with something pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that when I'm doing work on stage with people and they're playing behind me, I can riff like crazy. The trick to riffing or improvisational work is it doesn't really have to make sense. You just have to keep moving, and eventually something falls together or it doesn't. But if you have the music behind you, then it lifts it up. You can write poetry, and I've done that before, and I've had people put music behind it, so it becomes a song. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my songs or my poems are narrative anyway, so they're more or less leading in the direction of material that you could easily put music under. So do you ever go in the other direction where you've written a song, and then do you ever drop the guitar and just do spoken word with your song?
I've never really done that. That scares me. I look at poets, I look at comedians, I look at people that get up there and do words. And to me, that guitar probably is a security blanket for me. If I had to just recite my songs, my lyrics, I stumble up if I don't have the music behind me. So I really admire you and the poets that get up there and recite poems and it flows. And, I've always loved that, but no, I've never done that. Except back in my drinking days, every now and then I would get in these pontificating things, and I wish I had not all those nights recorded, but some of those nights recorded, where it takes you the words and the feeling, and I stop playing the guitar, and yeah, boy, when you catch one of those waves, it just feels spiritual.
And can you sing without the guitar? Just drop and sing, or do you have to have the guitar as a security?
It feels, it's part of the pacing and part of the, you know, I haven't, but I think that I'm kind of at a point in my life right now where I walked away from the music business and I said, never again. And, I am putting myself in positions right now where I'm putting myself in scary positions to try to break open some of the walls that I had put up. And it's scary and it's really exciting to just go, okay, you can go back to doing exactly what you used to do, or you can venture out. You can get a little braver. I do not often write from my perspective or experience. It wouldn't look like that if you looked at the lyrics. But I realize down the road, I think, ooh, a lot of my experience was in that song and I didn't even know it. But I really would love to work on writing my poetry, my lyrics that are more me. I think that was a way of me hiding creatively. I had a pretty weird childhood. I had a lot to get over. I had the benefit of a lot of music as a kid, which saved me. And I feel like when I look back at my body of work, I was usually writing for somebody else. I felt like that's going to be a very scary thing for me to get that vulnerable, to start writing songs from where I am right now, who I want to be.
When you say scary, can you play around with that a bit? And the reason I'm asking, scary is something people experience. You know, yeah. Then after they do it a bunch, they aren't scared anymore. So what do you mean by scared, and how does it fuel what you do rather than hinder it?
Well, I felt like, and it's no diss to Nashville, but a lot of their writing is pretty surface. It's a little bit paint by numbers. It's not scary. It's, we got to put this in, you know, truck, Daisy Dukes, let's get the beer. You know, there's a set of words that you have to put into a hit country song. And there aren't a whole lot of artists with real depth that are making it to the radio. So you keep following, even if you're trying to write from your soul, from your heart, which is a more vulnerable place. You keep hearing the sound of that. And that is getting, you know, the rat to the cheese that you're getting rewarded for this thing that doesn't feel like you. And at some point, I think I probably compromised myself out of the fear, because then it started kind of getting a little bit paint by number for me as well. So when I say scary, there are things that have happened to me in my life that I have never written about. My close friends, you and I and Allegra, had a beautiful conversation where I told you all some things that were very difficult to overcome. And as an artist, I have not dove into the deep end with that. And I would like to create some songs that actually explore some of those things that I've always skirted around.
Now, I have a layered question about that. And the reason it's coming up for me is because people would like to write about those very private things in their lives. And I've talked to many people that write memoirs and poetry. They say, well, I'm just scared to do that. I wonder if you did go at something, and I'm asking this question for myself as well, because I don't think I've done this, where you write something just so dramatically rip snorting, personal, you don't want anybody ever to see it, and you cue yourself into some emotional depth that would open doors that may not have been opened for other material that you could actually present to the public without feeling like it's going to bog you down, or you're going to get sued or murdered by the person you wrote about.
Yeah.
I'm being a little Southern country music dramatic there, but you know.
Well, I love that you said rip snorting. That was pretty.
Oh, well.
That was very Southern. Thank you. I don't know. I wrote one song about a young man that I had a crush on the commune in Alaska named Doug Courtney. And of course we were on an island there, and I just assumed after a while I gave up after the leader of the cult passed away, and thought, okay, I'm just going to marry Doug Courtney and we're going to have kids and live on the farm here. And that is the only topic, because Doug was very kind to me during a really hard time in my life. And that is the only song I've ever written about probably the most devastating years of my life from 10 to 15. And there are wonderful things that happened out there too. But that feeling of having no voice and just being only safe if I felt invisible, that's still something I have to really work on. And that applies to my writing. It's much easier to write things that don't offend people or don't make people go, what is her problem, man? And sometimes I wish I was that kind of writer. It would have been a much easier ride, I think. But I loved the songs where I dug, songs like Bullet, songs like Whiskey and a Gun that I woke up from. And they are not easy songs to perform, and they're not easy songs to listen to as a listener. They can be uncomfortable. And I always apologize for that side of my artistry, because I was so weird or out there, you know, and I don't want to apologize for that anymore. I want to do more of that.
I believe you didn't you sing both of those songs at I sang
Whiskey and a Gun. Yeah. Bullet in that setting with dogs running in and lightning bolts up. Probably that would have been a challenging setting for Bullet. Whiskey
and a Gun was really, really a powerful, powerful song.
Yeah.
And I could see that you didn't hesitate all the way to the end of that song.
Yeah.
Which you managed to take a really tragic ending and turn it into redemption.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go on, give us a quick review of what that song is about so people will know what I'm talking about. I was very impressed with it.
Thank you. It was, it's one of those songs I sat at my kitchen table alone, and I've only had three songs that I really felt like I got into that flow state where you almost check out. I remember starting Bullet. I remember finishing Bullet and going, what is this? And I did the same thing with Whiskey and a Gun. And I just became that woman. There are sometimes I perform it, especially if I, like I told you that when I performed at the Tennessee Women's State Prison with my friends, Shelley Tackett and Annie Mosier. And there are sometimes you just step into songs like that and you wake up when you finish performing them. There's some nights, I have years of performing that song that it gets to me. There are women out there who've lived that song. And it's basically a woman, clearly an abusive relationship. And he comes in from cheating and kind of unapologetic, rubs it in her face, and she takes him out. And she winds up in prison. And another real life scenario where somebody at the prison rapes her and she takes him out. I mean, in Nashville, they laugh. They're like, how many people are Carver going to kill tonight? So at the end of that song, and I love that sodium thiopental drip where she's laying there, she's going out and she's going, okay, I shouldn't have done this. I don't know what's going to happen now, but I'm going out, you know. I love that the outro was kind of like, yeah, you guys should have run, you know, from Whiskey and a Gun. At some point, the woman's had enough, you know. And in Nashville, they would have said, okay, how can we have a happy ending to that?
Well, did have a happy ending, Carver. Well, in a way, it was redemption.
It felt like, yep, she's going out. She shouldn't have done it, but they shouldn't have done her wrong either. But in Nashville, they would have said, well, maybe she could have gotten out and gotten married happily and had, you know, three babies and then lived. And that's not always how things work out. And I think Nashville got tired of telling me, write a Disney ending. And it's, you know, I have been writing songs recently that are all over the map. Love songs, which back in the day, publishers were like, write love songs. And I just wasn't feeling those. So that's where you separate the commercially successful writers who can write whatever they're told to write. They need a up-tempo for somebody. They're going to go in there and they're going to put all the things in and do a melody, you know, hooky melody. And I actually really respect and admire that.
Yeah.
It's just not my favorite way to create. So
here you are, your children are grown. you have a Martin, which you were playing. I saw from a distance and recognized that as a Martin. And I thought, well, that's, of course, what she would play. And you maybe even have a name for it. You maybe even have a relationship with it, like you do with your dog. I don't know, you know, don't mess with my Martin and don't mess with my dog kind of thing.
You know, that's actually my backup guitar that my friend Ed Beaver gave to me after American Airlines lost my custom guitar that was made for me by my ex, Tom Bresch, who was a guitar wizard. And he goes, you don't wear rings, so this is your engagement ring. And he gave me this beautiful, it's called a Spirit, Tom Bresch Spirit guitar. A guy named Harvey Leach in Grass Valley, California, amazing luthier, human being. So I've had that guitar. I wrote all those songs on my Bresch Spirit.
Mm.
And I came back from Nashville two summers ago after an emotional goodbye to Bresch, going through his storage and helping his daughter sort out his things. And then one of my songwriting heroes, Jonathan Long, we had a service for him at Idle Hour. He was an old bartender that could outwrite anybody. And I love sending people in. Ask Jonathan to play Old Black and Blues and you'll never get over it. So it was an emotional week already, and I had been bumped. I had spent an extra night in Nashville, and I got up to American Airlines and they said, we don't have room for a purse up there, much less your guitar. You're going to have to check it. And I went, oh, no, I can't check this guitar. It's a custom made guitar. It's, you know, and I was so tired that I wound up checking it and saying, please promise me this is going to land in Santa Fe, not a scratch on it. They said, you're overthinking this. Don't worry about it. But I had that gut feeling that you get. And I just something, man, I should have turned around, caught the next flight. I got to Santa Fe and my suitcase made it. My guitar never showed up. And it was gone 9 months. And I kept calling and they were like, well, send us a check. And I said, this isn't a guitar that you send a check. I need that guitar. It's the only one in the whole world. And I don't travel with that guitar anymore, but they had sold that guitar to the lost luggage thing in Alabama. And a guy paid $150 and bought my guitar. And I fell to my knees when I got that phone call. Harvey Leach called me and he said, you need to call this guy in Alabama right now. And I just screamed. And I sent a friend to pick up the guitar. He goes, do you want me to ship it to you? And I said, oh, no, don't you dare ship that guitar to me. So guitars are like my babies as well. But Spirit has retired. She does not go out much anymore and definitely won't travel with her. So the Martin, my friend Ed Beaver said, man, I'm not using this guitar. I got it from Reba McEntire doing a benefit when we lost all of our guitars in the floods. And he said, I want to give you this guitar. And I love that Martin. It's a beautiful guitar.
Is it a Martin D28, D35, or it's some?
It's a D28, and it is. It took me a while because the fret is bigger. The neck is bigger, and the frets are a little different. And I'm used to playing that Spirit, which is like, it's like an electric neck. It's real easy, and a Bresch would set those strings so low, the action so low, it's like butter. You barely have to move your fingers, you know. And the Martin took a little bit of getting used to, but man, yeah, it's my baby now. And you know how protective I am of my babies.
Well, I know you told the story about how you don't like somebody messing with your dog, and I totally, totally understand it. And a lot of people who own their dogs feel the same way. And people who have guitars, I know they are massively protective of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Don't threaten my kids or my dogs or my guitars. And I'm a very loving person otherwise.
So you are now, you got your guitar back.
Mm-hmm.
You have your Martin. You are in Taos, New Mexico right now, where you've been living quietly for some time, as you told me. But you're getting ready to go back out on the road. And you're no longer 22 years old. You're in the prime of your life as a songwriter. What's the strategy? Where are you going to go? How are you going to approach this arena? And I'm asking this because this show airs in Asheville, North Carolina, as well as here in Towson up into Alamoso. I know for sure in Asheville, there are a lot of young women, men too, but I know a lot of young women who are doing this singer-songwriter thing.
Yeah.
You've been in the shoot a long time. You're a pro. I mean, if you dropped onto a stage with 60,000 people, you would just say, turn it up and let's play. Yeah. You could handle it, no problem. So where are you going to go with all of this?
Honestly, I don't know. I have some shows set up in California and Alabama in October, and I'm just going to kind of piddle around, and I want to do a life cleanse. I'm just feeling tethered in many ways. And I want to get rid of everything that doesn't really matter to me. I'm going to make, you know, maybe take my favorite 50 books on the road. I'm going to take my two guitars, my dog, and notebooks. And I'm old school that way. Everybody laughs at me. Everybody gets their computers out to write, and I have to do pen and paper. And I just am feeling the need to get rid of the clutter and the noise and get quiet, go hang out by some rivers. And it's been a lot of avoiding my gift, and it's time to focus on that again. I got out just enough recently that I go, okay, I love the music. I love the people. I love performing if it's not hot or cold. And it's something kicks back in, even though I feel rusty and I fight with that whole imposter syndrome and not feeling like my skills are, you know, do I have anything left to say? I have all those questions that, you know, a lot of artists, especially women, fight with. I don't look 20 anymore. I don't have what the music business would look for in an artist. But when I play live shows, man, something kicks in. There is a love, there's a give and take, and there's a flow. And they don't care if you're authentic and you are singing things from the heart. It's something I need to do, but I feel like I need some different material. I'm still singing a lot of things I wrote back before therapy, like I was saying.
It's interesting because authenticity and truth has no age.
Bingo.
So it doesn't matter if you're 14 or 97, if yes. You somehow hit that pulse.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to, you mentioned your gift, and the way you said your gift, the way you said gift was a bit like the way you say dog and guitar. It's a character in your life play. Talk about the relationship you have with your gift. The reason I'm curious about it is because you know it's there. A lot of people don't have a relationship with their gift. They don't even think they have one. You do. Well, what's that relationship like, and how does it play out?
You know, as a little kid, and I didn't realize at the time, I definitely have some neurodivergent things happening. And a little kid, I just remember being drawn to the piano, being drawn to anything that made music. My brother taught me G, C, and D when I was 6 years old, and I would strum them over and over to the point of everyone was at the other side of the house. I had a weird need. I had a need for it as a kid. My mother was a gospel singer and taught me how to harmonize with her when I was young. And she was so patient, and I would, you know, I'd hit the wrong note, or I'd go to fourth rather than third. And the other kids, I just noticed they didn't have that drive. I had that. I just wanted music. I needed it. And then when I got into that weird religion, they had some of the worst songs I've heard in my life. Not right. And I swear part of that, I would sit there and go, oh, this could have been written so much better. And I actually, my friends Tackett and Mosher in Nashville, they would sing harmonies to these songs. When we were driving on the road going to gigs, they would pick out harmonies and they would go, man, these are terrible songs. And I would say, this is another reason why I wanted to be a songwriter. I felt like songs, man, I've had songs that saved my life. They've moved me. And they usually, Green Grass, oh my gosh, lay your head where my heart used to be. Hold the earth above me. Lay down in the green grass. Remember when you loved me. Tom Waits, Leonard Cohen, those artists that hit you on a level you can't even explain. I knew that I didn't have, I don't have a great voice. I'm not a great guitar player. I'm not great at any of that. But I bring something that connects with people. On a good night, it connects in a way that I know it's a gift. Not everybody has that. People can be great technical singers or players or writer, you know, and they don't always connect with people. And I think when I get material that is really coming from a real place, that I'm going to connect again in a way that I need and that my people need.
When I watched you the other night, the other group that was on, they were fine. I liked it.
Oh, they're great. Yeah, I love them.
And no problem. They were good singers. They were interesting, colorful. Mm-hmm. I could go on and on. When you stepped up there, though, I know what you're talking about, because somehow, whatever you did, you framed yourself. Mm. There was a frame around it.
Interesting.
And I don't know where, I'm not speaking mystically here. It's just you brought this focus to it. And it went for me from being, well, this is kind of an interesting outdoor concert, a gathering of folks, to, wow, what is that?
Yeah.
And it was you, but it was, what is that? Mm. And even when your dog stepped on stepped on the pedal and the whole thing just went haywire, it didn't really seem to matter. And even the thunder came and the lightning came and you finally said, and I loved it when you said, well, the bam and crash and the lightning's going around. And she says, well, I think it's time to stop. Okay, everybody go in and eat. And you just walked off. But there was a frame around it that is part of that, whatever that is. And you have identified it. And I also think by saying, well, I'm not that great a guitar player. Well, you're not Jimi Hendrix and, you know, you're not a master guitar player. Mm-hmm. I'm not that great a singer, but I have the gift. So the gift is a connection to some kind of greatness. I don't know what it is, but it's some connection.
It's something that I've felt, is bigger than me in moments on stage that I've had before where, you know, I'm up there with people that can out sing, out play, out do all that. But when I get in that frame is an interesting thing, a frame where I am really appreciating and feeling that it's a connection. It's something that I feel like I catch a wave with people in the audience and I will meet eyes on certain songs. I sing a song, Pretty People's Feet, Bullet. There are certain songs of mine that on those nights when you're in the beautiful fishbowl, you meet people's eyes and it's just this, and I've missed it. But it's scary getting back out there because I know I'm rusty and people that would see me 20 years ago now will go, oh my God, yeah, she's got to step up her skills again. And that's the only way to do that is to get out there and put your neck out, you know.
I've watched a lot of stuff. I mean, you're rusty if you haven't been out there, but I didn't see that. What I saw was a lot of skill being played out in a situation that had a lot of challenges. And that frame that I'm talking about, now that I think about it, that frame, I may have been the one that put the frame around you because the focus that you brought to it allowed me to frame it. You might not have been creating that frame. The audience, being me and whomever else watching may have created the frame. And that's a positive thing. It just kind of happens. Don't want to be too mystical. It's not a halo. Let's keep it square, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think that Alaska, a religious cult, is a long haul from Nashville, Tennessee? How did you get yourself all the way up to a grizzly bear country?
Oh, man. So born in Charleston, South Carolina, good Baptist family. Dad was an insurance salesman, mom gospel singer. I'm the youngest of five kids. And when I was 6 years old, my aunt met a woman in Charleston who was, for lack of a better phrase, a recruiter for this cult, this religion called the Move of God or the Body of Christ. A guy named Sam Fife, he was the leader. And I read yesterday that there were 10,000 people in that cult, which I didn't know there were that many, but they were all over the world. And he told us we needed to separate ourselves from the world and basically do everything he said, and we would live forever. We would become the next body of Christ. And it's, I spent a lot of years pretty mad about the fact that I did feel like I had my childhood kind of stolen away, but it made for some great stories. And I have all the material I need if I finally get brave enough to write about that place. But we became part of that member. We would meet in houses all over Charleston. And eventually the plan was to move to this little commune in Alaska where my aunt moved. So the summer of 78, my dad had converted a big school bus into a living room on wheels, and we all piled in. I remember I had never seen him cry, except an incident with my brother, and he pulled that school bus out of my grandmother's driveway. I remember the pecan trees swaying and looking over, and he had tears in his eyes. He didn't know if that would be the last time he'd see his mom. He was an only child. So it took us almost a month to drive across up the Alcan Highway. We landed in Haines and then had to take a boat to get to Hoonah, Alaska. And I was 10 years old that summer. And I stepped off. It was around midnight. And we stepped off. And it was mud and rain and a cemetery. And I went, oh, my life is about to change in a big way. And the next morning, we took the boat 3 miles away by water out to the commune. And I just remember a woman coming up to me and saying, you are never to wear pants again without a skirt over them. That is the rule here. You ride, horseback ride, and you swim, always have a skirt on. And I just remember looking for the, back then, candid camera was a big thing. And I just remember looking for the cameras like, this has to be a joke. What is this place? So we ate 3 meals a day in the big tabernacle, and there were 145 people that year. And, you know, so you have a bunch of city slickers that moved into this little cabin. It was a 12 by 12 main room A-frame, and then 2 8 by 12 rooms on the side. My dad left about a month and a half later, I think, because my grandmother got sick. We didn't see him again for 9 months. So it was my mom and my siblings and I in that little cabin trying to figure out how to start fires in a wood stove. And, you know, we had an outhouse. We were pumping water out of the well. It was like Little House on the Prairie, except with some very strange religious people. I mean, and there were great people out there. Most of them were really great. It was the few that made it pretty challenging as a kid who was rebellious and asked questions. And, you know, that wasn't condoned.
And how long did it last before you managed to extract yourself? Or you were 10 years old. You didn't have much choice in the matter, did you?
No, I didn't have any choice. 5 years later, my dad's back and forth while his mom was sick, and then she'd get better and he'd come back. And we were there. Oh, we were there a year when Sam Fife, we got called in from the fields. The tsunami siren rang and I was like, yes, we get a break. And they said, no, come on in. We have some news. And they told us Sam Fife had crashed his plane in Guatemala. And I remember this little spark of hope was like, oh my God. And I was like, Mom, can we go home? She was like, no, hush, Lisa. And so the guy who told us we'd live forever was dead. And I kind of thought, okay, well, clearly this was not, you know. So they said, no, he was a sacrificial lamb. And I remember that year kind of giving up and going, okay, I'm stuck here. I'm stuck here on this island. Thankfully, my dad, I think he just had a Grizzly Adams fantasy. He was never really into the religious part of it. And he had trained this horse named Sunrise, big, beautiful gelding, black stallion. I mean, just gorgeous white stripe on his face. But he was still young and he was feisty and he apparently scared one of the elders' kids and they shot him and ate him. And when Dad came back that next trip and he goes, where's Sunrise? Where's the horse? And we told him, and I saw his eyes kind of, that was it for him. So the other kids had a very different experience than I did. We had my middle siblings were very just kind of good kids, mellow. It was just a very different thing for them. They were kind of the golden children and they chose to stay there. And Dad moved Mom and I to that little fishing village, Huna, 3 miles away. And so I got to spend my sophomore, junior, and senior year of high school in that little town. And I graduated from a class of 11.
That's a long way from Charleston, South Carolina.
It's a long way from Charleston.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was hard. A lot of those years were hard on me. But I also met some people I would have never run into in Charleston, South Carolina. We had wonderful teachers on the commune. We had the Careys and the Banizaks, and I got to learn a year of classical guitar with Lenny Banizak, who studied under Segovia. I would have never run into a lot of the wonderful experiences that I had there. But I definitely rebelled, and I spent a long time kind of choking back that anger and all that. There was a lot of rage that was repressed. And I was taught to always be pleasant, put on a smile and be the good Southern girl. And man, the wheels came off in a big way when I finally got out of there.
What do they say down south? The Lord works in strange ways. And if you grow up in the South, as I did and as you did, you know what I'm talking about more than just one thing when we say that. So, Carver, we have arrived at the time when we have to say goodbye to this conversation because we're almost at the top of the hour. And before we go, tell us how we can get in touch with you. If people want to track your music, where do they find it? You're all over the YouTube. I mean, all you have to do is just type in, I guess it's Carver. You go by Carver last name, but.
Yeah, Lisa Carver. Okay. This is the other part that I really have to work on. I do not like dealing with social media and all this. I'm looking at you and Allegra and your websites. Everything's so beautiful. So I need to work on having my music, my art out there, because I everything's out of date. I need to get a website and all that going again. But until then, enjoy YouTube.
Lisa Carver on YouTube, and if anybody listening would like to reach Lisa, you can just email me nave@jamesnave.com, and I have Lisa's phone number. I'll just pass it on over.
I am the last person on BellSouth.net. I am at Lisa lisacarver@bellsouth.net. Yeah, but I'm going to work on that. I'm putting that on my to-do list.
Well, Carver, thank you for taking the time to be with us, and I appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh. I appreciate you, what you and Allegra do, and thank you for being such a great listener. I've talked to Kylie about that. You have a lot of gifts, but what a gift it was to me for you to listen to my story and ask questions and to be there at that concert that had a whole lot of challenges, and just to be kind and loving as well as brilliant. What a great combination.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And maybe we'll do this again.
I'd love that. Thank you, Navi.
And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Carver. If you would like to find her work on YouTube, type in Lisa Carver and you will see a great deal of the work come up. I couldn't believe how comfortable I was during this conversation with Carver. She brought out the Southern in me. I find that when I'm talking to musicians from the South, since I did grow up in the South and I did grow up playing music in the South, I find that there's a common language I can speak with them. And it's more than the words that I say and the words the musician like Carver says back to me. There's something else underneath it, an understanding, a bit of a delight. I just got an email from a friend of mine who wants me to give him some quotes about a book of poetry that he's written. And his poetry is all about compassion and grace and understanding. And it's very, very religious in the sense of the openness and forgiveness of religion. Now, I buy into that. And yet when I talk to people like Carver, those country musicians, I find myself more drawn to the Duende of it. Not everybody lives in a country song, as Carver said earlier in this interview. I don't know how many people you're going to kill tonight, Carver. And it's not about who kills whom or who robs what or what kind of heartbreak happens. The reason I like the country music idea, and this sometimes falls into other song categories as well, but most especially with country music, because I do understand that, it deals with a whole range of things. So even in the tragedy, you have some kind of insight, some kind of redemption, something happens. Billy Joe McAllister jumps off the Tallahatchie Bridge. I'm a lineman for the county, looking up into the wires to try to find my lost love. By the time I get to Phoenix, you'll be rising. There's tragedy built into a lot of these songs, but there's also a great deal of joy built into it as well. I have an appreciation for it. And yet, as I said to Carter, I do have that one line, get me drunk and call me darling. If you ain't been lied to, you ain't been loved. Or a variation on it, get me drunk and call me darling. If you ain't been tattered, you ain't been loved. You could put both of them together and throw in a few other things like summer sun falling out of the sky in the rattling days when the time goes by and the sunset flits across the western sky in the dragonfly's dreams that pass me by. That was actually not so bad, I think. Okay, you go ahead and put some music to that and we'll make a song. Meanwhile, we've made it to the end of this show, and with that in mind, I would like to say I do appreciate you tuning in. I hope you enjoyed what Carter had to say. I'm looking forward to returning with her to another rendezvous. She's going on tour. She'll be down in Alabama in October and headed to Nashville, and she says she's going to swing by Asheville, where I will be, and she wants to do a little house concert. So if you're in Asheville and you'd like to come to the house concert, I'll send you an invitation. All you have to do is send me a little email, and I'll invite you to come over to the show. Nave@jamesnave.com. That's how you can send me that little email if you want to. So again, thank you ever so much for being with me for this time and for tuning in. I appreciate it. This is Twice 5 Miles Radio. and fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Thank you, Walter Parks, for our theme song, walterparks.com, for more on Walter's music. Daveen Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville. And Robin Kohler and Mike Tilley, you do the same in Taos. KCEI, Cultural Energy Radio, Taos, New Mexico. Broadcasting also in Alamosa. Great places. I enjoy it all. I'm finishing my last bit of time here in Taos for this season. I'm headed east in about 2 weeks. Right now, I'm sitting under some wisteria. Old dog Marley, nice big black lab, must weigh 125 pounds, is at my feet. Sun's dappling on the mountains. The clouds are a fluffy gray, white, and a bit of blue in the sky. And I'm just rolling along. If you would like to do one last thing with me, every Saturday I gather with my creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, and we write for 10 minutes, and we do it within the context of 1 hour. It's a workshop, conversation, seminar, salon that we've been doing for 5 years. If you like to write, you can always join us. We would love to have you. Open community that's just absolutely terrific. You can go to imaginativestorm.com for information on how to connect with us on Saturday. That's 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern time. If you're somewhere else in the world, you can do the math. All right. Thank you ever so much for being part of this community, joining me, listening to Carver. And I do hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
We, the rock and roll generation, have never found our self-defining first rock and roll song. Host Jamie DeLappa presents music and musicians you've never heard, who pioneered rock and roll. Songs that could have been the first rock and roll song. Songs that fill the gap in understanding where we came from and who we are today. Saturday afternoons at 2, here on Radio Asheville.
Listen to a lonely sound. See the gray and sadness all around. See the people go their way. Care not of me and love I've lost today. Maybe tomorrow I will love again. I'll never know until I've looked to her eyes. Maybe tomorrow I will love again. I'll never know until I've seen her once or twice. And so I'm living for a dream. Each lonely day spent looking for the sunshine. I'll make believe that I don't care. I'll tell my friends I love my life. I'm happy. Maybe tomorrow I will love again. I'll never know until I've looked into her eyes. Maybe tomorrow I I'll never know until I've seen her once or twice. Wherever, whoever you may be, let the light of your love shine through the window of my heart. I've looked into her eyes. Maybe tomorrow you will love again. I'll never know until I've seen her once or twice. Maybe tomorrow you will love again. Maybe tomorrow I will love.
listening to WPVN.